Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And hey everybody, welcome back to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Nguyen.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to talk about our July 2019 book club pick, Zero Sum Game by S.L. Huang. As always, here is your spoiler warning on the top. We're going to be talking all about this book. So if you haven't read it yet and don't want things to get spoiled for you, go read the book right now and come back and listen to us afterward. But yeah, Rira, how has your summer been so far?
It's disgusting.
It's getting pretty... Do you feel like it's more humid this year in LA?
Yeah, it really is. And it makes me so mad because I did not move out of Georgia for this nonsense. Like, it felt like New York as well, because New York gets, like, really humid.
Yeah, I was just in New York, and it's worse than here for sure. But
yeah.
I was expecting to come back to, like, our usual, like...
dry summer.
Oven, right? Yeah. But it's been kind of muggy and...
and gross.
We're not built for that.
No, we're not.
When it's muggy, there's mosquitoes and I don't like them. They suck.
Oh my God. Speaking of bugs, like our apartment right outside our door, we had like a beehive.
Oh no.
Or I guess like a bee hole where like a lot of bees were like coming in and out. Mm. And it just like happened randomly one day. We're like, where did all these bees come from?
So like, we had to right outside your apartment.
Yeah, like right outside our apartment. And I didn't notice. I just like walked straight past the swarm because
really?
I was on my phone, whereas like Dan walked around the other side of the building and he was like, did you not see the swarm of bees that was like right outside our apartment? And I was like, oh yeah, we need to call someone for that. And I guess like our landlord, she was just like, oh, it can't be that serious. But then when she called like the bee person, he like checked and he was like, oh no, I need a bee suit for this.
Oh, so wow.
it was pretty serious and we couldn't leave our apartment for like 3 hours.
You live there now forever.
Outside is their domain.
Right.
I'm intruding on their home.
You need to just call on Uber Eats from now on to get any food delivered or Amazon Fresh.
Yeah. Well, they're gone now. So thank God.
That's good. Like, how does bee removal work?
So like the bee guy, he sprayed something that smelled so bad. Like, it smells so bad to like humans as well. But it's supposed to like make the bees kind of go crazy and be like, this is not a good place to live. So they kind of move out. So yeah, it doesn't kill them or anything.
Okay. They just move the queen somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Well.
Well, that was my summer so far. It's been quite exciting.
Yeah, my summer's been pretty low-key. I went to New York for a wedding that didn't happen. Nothing, like, scandalous. It's just...
You went to New York, like, a couple, like, 2 weeks after I came back from New York.
That's true.
Yeah.
I bet it was really... places. Yeah, but it was super muggy. And it was like, it's summer, like rainstorm season, you know, where it's like it rains for 10 minutes every 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reminded of my time back in the East Coast when I used to live in D.C. and like, oh, yeah, I should really check the weather before I exit the house. Because when I was living in D.C., I got caught in rainstorms like all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here with like New York. Like, I never went anywhere without an umbrella.
Yeah. That's something.
Whereas here, like, people don't check the weather ever. Yeah. And people get so surprised when it rains and they drive so slowly, which is a thing that is mentioned in this book. Because this book takes place in LA. And if you live in LA, you'll get all of the, like, you'll understand, like, the neighborhoods and kind of, like, the subcultures. And it was kind of, like, fun being in the know-how.
I will say, as easy as it is to talk shit about L.A. traffic and drivers, have you driven anywhere else in the world? Like, people are worse drivers everywhere else.
That's not true. I drove in Atlanta, and it is way better than here in L.A. Like, way better.
Mm.
Our traffic is almost just as bad, but it's like the drivers are much nicer.
Are they?
Yeah.
Hmm. See, I drove around DC and that traffic is worse and the drivers are worse.
Oh, well, I've never had the fortune, or I guess misfortune, of driving there. Have you seen the movie Baby Driver?
I have not, actually.
It takes place in Atlanta.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, I know those streets. Yeah. And it's another movie slash... I guess, piece of media where, like, fast drivers are fighting against traffic in, like, a very big city. So, anyway, we're going to jump right in to our...
we're going to talk about our July book club pick.
All right, and here is the summary, as always. Cass Russell is good at math. Scary good. The vector calculus blazing through her head lets her smash through armed men twice her size and dodge every bullet in a gunfight. And she'll take any job for the right price. As far as Cass knows, she's the only person around with a superpower, until she discovers someone with a power even more dangerous than her own. Someone who can reach directly into people's minds and twist their brains into Mobius strips. Someone intent on becoming the world's puppet master. Cass should run, like she usually does, but for once, she's involved. There's only one problem. She doesn't know which of her thoughts are her own anymore. Okay, I'm going to start off this talk with our relationship with math. Like, were you a good Asian and knew your math growing up?
I took multivariable differential calculus in college.
Oh, man. I don't even know what that means.
That's about as far as I went because that was the requirement for it. So when I was in college, I went to college at UC San Diego, and my major was, it was called Management Science. It's basically economics based on, like, the micro side, so firm side stuff. But it was a BS degree. So because it was a BS degree, and that's Bachelor of Science, not bullshit.
Not bullshit.
But also bullshit. We had to take engineering level calculus as our general requirement instead of regular calculus. So that's how I learned about, you know, three-dimensional shapes and how to find volume.
So did you understand, like, a lot of the math terms that showed up in this book?
So I understood in the way that, like, I understood how the relationship math has to, like, physics and stuff. Like, yeah, this is how parkour people do the things they do, because they know how to transfer energy. And it's like, did you watch Sherlock Holmes, the Guy Ritchie version?
No.
The one with Robert Downey Jr.? That was Guy Ritchie, right?
I don't know, but I saw the one with Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah. Could have sworn that was Guy Ritchie. I might be wrong. But it's like, what if that boxing scene in the beginning, but the whole movie?
Oh my God, that's exactly what I was thinking when I was reading the book. I was like, man, this is like Sherlock Holmes. Like, you do all the calculations and then you execute it.
Yeah.
And everything is like, since your brain is like figuring out all the ways that you can beat this person.
Right.
Like, everything slows down. And I thought that was like really cool. And I thought if this book was made into a movie, it would do that like 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like really interesting because like I had like a movie reference for it.
Right.
Yeah.
But what is your relationship with math?
I hate it so much. I hate it so much. I feel like I was really more math oriented until maybe like high school. Because like in high school, like they introduced like pre-calculus and like that did not go over very well. That was around the time when my English teachers were telling me that I was a really bad writer and I was really bad at reading comprehension, and that if I continued this way, I would never get into college. So I started like practicing writing and started reading a lot of books. I was a big reader when I was younger, but like I started reading like much more difficult books outside of genre books. So I went from like a math oriented person to like definitely like more language based. So that was an interesting transition for me, but I haven't taken math since maybe like junior year of high school.
Right.
I went to film school and like no math was required.
Not even for like basic graduation requirements or anything?
No, math was not required for basic. Science was, but I took like a children's literature class and that counted as like psychology. So I didn't have to take any science or math. I took a lot of history classes. I could have double minored. I have a minor in producing, but like I could have double minored with producing and Renaissance art history.
Right.
Because I took so many classics classes. It was like crazy. But yeah. I have a very minimal relationship with math. I try to avoid it as much as possible. So a lot of the math terms in this book just kind of flew over my head.
I mean, but it's great that the author or whoever did the marketing of the book explains that the math power as a superpower, because that gives you the frame of reference on how to approach the main character, Cass Russell's math skills. It's like, yeah, I think it acts as a great shorthand for like, yeah, of course you can do this stuff, math, which is the way that she describes it too. And towards the end of the book, they seem to allude that it's not as simple as that. Like the math powers come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm,
It's, you know, because that was something while I was reading the book, I was thinking, yeah, sure, she's great at math, but normal people don't compute this fast. So I was trying to figure out, is she like a character on the spectrum maybe? Like, is there a reason her brain is wired that way? Or is it like something else? And it seems to be something else.
Yeah. I mean, it would be, I mean, this book is like technically like urban fantasy or paranormal fantasy, because obviously you have elements that are like not possible in real life. And it's just like, even if you could compute that fast, your body normally can't follow those calculations that quickly. So, like, I just kind of figured that she had some kind of weird superpower to begin with. And once you get to the end and kind of like a little bit of her origin story is kind of like being revealed, I was like, okay, well, I guess that will be the thing that shows up in the second book, because this is a series of 4 books.
Yeah.
The series was actually self-published before it got picked up by Tor Books, and they republished it after it was like edited and polished a little bit.
Okay.
So Zero Sum Game actually was republished last year in October 2018.
So the entire series is already out?
No, it's not already out. The second book, let me pull up what the second book. So the second book is Null Set, and that was released last month under Tor Books.
Wow.
So they are releasing it in kind of like a traditional publishing basis, like a book every year and a half. So it's really, really rare for a self-published book to be picked up by traditional publishing. It's something that almost never happens, so it kind of shows like how much appeal there was to pick up this book.
And I
mentioned this when we first announced this book as our book club pick, but S.L. Huang, she is freaking amazing. Like, she sounds like the coolest person I have ever like heard about in terms of authors.
I mean, we talked about our collegiate background, but if we were in a straight up competition of best Asian, she would win.
S.L. Huang, she has a math degree from MIT, which is like, whoa, that is like the most amount of math. And she's actually a professional stunt woman and an arms expert.
Yeah, that was something when I was reading the book, I was like, man,
there's a lot of
really
weapons
loves
here.
Guns.
Yeah.
And like, I was able to pick up on the names only because of my extensive video game experience, specifically the Resident Evil games, which also has a surprisingly affinity for like specific guns.
It would make sense. Resident Evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those gun games. I'm not a guns fan, and I really don't like to play games where weapons are like super specific, because to me they're all the same.
Yeah.
So like that was another thing that just kind of like kind of went over my head, like the math terms and like the totally like different types of guns.
Her preference for not Glocks.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but like I get it. Like she is very Cass is very specific about her weapons, and I guess like that kind of played into the humor of things. So yeah. But this book was very, very, very different from the past books that we have read for Books and Boba. It was almost like we were reading a blockbuster action, like action screenplay.
Yeah.
Like it really, like, I don't know. There was so much action, and I don't think I've ever read that much action in a book before.
Well, I mean, the last book that we read that was similar to this was IQ, which similarly had like set piece scenes, but just not as much, I feel like. This one like started it off right from the bat.
Yeah.
Right.
It definitely did like the traditional like screenplay opening scene where like you're in the middle of like a great battle or some kind of like.
Oh, I know like, this term in media res.
Yes. Yes. So I really like the way the book started, like start with a bang. And it kind of like showed like it kind of showed me like what type of book this was going to be. I was like, okay, there is a lot of action, there's a lot of speed, but is there going to be a lot of mystery? So I wasn't really quite sure if this was going to become like a detective procedural halfway
right.
through, or because you were introduced to a PI, Arthur Trusting,
right?
And I was like, is this going to turn into a procedural? But no, it was like all action throughout. I said this before we started recording. The book really reminded me of Jessica Jones, or at least like the limited number of episodes I've watched of Jessica Jones, where you have like a very like antisocial, really aggressive, impulsive female character who kind of like is outside the norm of typical heroines.
Right.
And just kind of like being in like half noir and half like superhero action movie.
Right.
It was like a weird blend, but I was kind of into it.
Right. And it wasn't a cat and mouse type of story. It's not like the chase is afoot type of story. It was like different people with different agendas like kind of coming to a head, right? And like it definitely felt more like to use like the Marvel movie analogy, like the Winter Soldier, right?
I've never watched it, so
I mean it felt like did you watch the Bourne movies?
Like maybe like two, so I have limited knowledge of the series.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm being so unhelpful with my pop culture knowledge.
It definitely felt more like a spy thriller than like a traditional detective story.
Yeah. What did you think when, I guess, like the first hint that it was going to be paranormal / superhero? Because you find out when like the main villain, Donna Polk.
Right.
Yeah, she's revealed to be some kind of like telepath. And for me, because I went into the book cold, I really need to stop doing that. But like I went into the book cold and I wasn't quite sure what the genre was going to be, aside
right.
from like there is a mystery and there is going to be a lot of action. So I was really surprised when I got to that part in the book.
So I had read the description on Goodreads. So I had an idea that mind control had something to do with it. I wasn't sure what level it was going to be, if it's going to be full on like superpower telepathy, or was it going to be some sort of like, because I knew the theme was like math person, right? So I wasn't sure if it was going to be some sort of like couched in science or anything. And it still might be. I mean, we don't know the real nature of the mind control powers, but I had already known that there was going to be something strange going on.
Yeah, something outside the norm of like a thriller.
I did start to catch on to the inconsistencies of Cass's character during that first scene where she talks to Donna about giving her an update on Courtney the person that she went to go rescue, the fact that she was telling her where she was going, who she was seeing.
And her being, like, very, like, emotionally invested.
Yeah.
Because I was like, wait, why did you turn really, like, I don't know, like, concerned about your client? It just seemed really out of character. And I wasn't really sure in the beginning if that was just, like, a mistake.
Mm.
But, you know, it's just really good setup, I think.
I mean, the fact that she told her exactly where she was going to. And, like, that's when I already knew at that point that Donna was not on the level. I didn't realize she was the big bad, but that, like, she was the only person she told that that was where she was going.
Yeah.
Right. And then the ambush happens, so.
I mean, my guess right off the bat was like, oh, she's, like, the big bad because she's the client, and it's always the client. And I'm not saying that, like, it's super cliche, but it does tend to happen. And I think Huang did a pretty good job of kind of making it unpredictable because you're like, okay, she's involved and she might be the big bad, but I don't really know what her agenda is. So it kind of like strung you along as a reader.
I mean, the unpredictability came from that point on when you realized that nobody can really be 100% trusted, right? Except for probably real, but even then, not really.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is why, like, it kind of reminded me of Jessica Jones, because David Tennant's character, he kind of has, like, that similar ability to influence people's minds.
That's
and
true.
Make people think that they're doing the right thing. He can make them feel whatever he wants them to feel. So it really did give me that, like the similarities definitely struck a chord with me.
Right.
But also, I don't know if you've seen Miss Sherlock. It's like the female Japanese version of Sherlock Holmes.
It's on HBO, right?
Yeah, in like modern day settings, and the same exact power is in that series as well. You have spoiler warning. So you have Watson goes to a therapist, and the therapist turns out to be the big bad, and she's like she ends up being Moriarty, and she's able to kind of brainwash people very gradually to make them serve her purposes. And she does it in a way where she thinks that she is helping people for the greater good.
Right.
So, like, I was like, huh, another mystery / thriller with mind control involved. I was like, is there a theme with these types of stories? Probably, because this book specifically covers the theme of moral gray areas.
Yeah, like relative morality, right? Like,
because you have a character, Rio, who is a very violent psychopath, but he's also religious, and he's also cast as, like, best friend, but not really a friend, kind of weird relationship. And it's like, you know that he is essentially a bad person. He enjoys torture, and he seems to have no qualms or emotions attached to that.
Well, I don't think he enjoys it. Does he enjoy it?
Yeah, he is a sadist.
Hmm.
But he only tortures and kind of extracts information from bad people.
He's like Dexter, right? But instead of, like, the code of his foster father, it's the code of Christianity,
yeah,
which even, like, he or Cass mentions that it's not because he is religious, he needs a code, and that's the code that he chose for himself.
Were there any characters where you were kind of like, okay, I'm not really sure if I'm lined up with their moral code?
I mean, this whole novel wants to ask the question, like, what is morality? What is right? This is funny because I'm playing Fire Emblem Three Kingdoms right now on my Switch, and they're asking the same questions, which is, do the ends justify the means, right? If the end goal is a more peaceful world, does that justify the bloody path it takes to get there and the bad things you have to do? Is it moral to sacrifice a few people to save millions, right?
Yeah.
And this is, like, a story that's been told
in various
mediums. In various forms, especially in superhero fiction, right, where, like, especially in good superhero fiction, where the villain is the hero of their own story, and they're not evil for evil's sake. They're evil because they want to create a new world order. They see corruption, and they go about it in morally bad ways.
Mm-hmm.
Stories that frame villainy in that light, I like a lot better than the straight up like good guy versus bad guy, right?
Because yeah.
It challenges you to think about worldviews and think about the corruptions that would lead a person to become that way, right? Because not everyone can be the Joker. Not everyone can be chaos, right? Like what Pithika, the quote-unquote bad guy organization in the story is, they're all about order, right? They're lawful, right? If you think about it in terms of, you know, RPG alignments, they're probably like lawful evil.
Yeah.
Not lawful evil. They're
lawful chaotic? I don't know. I'm not a D&D person, so right. I don't really know all the quadrants.
Lawful
sorry.
Evil would be if they're a bad guy using law for their own means, which is not them. They think they're doing good. They're probably lawful good. They believe in order. They believe in sacrifice. They believe in, like, they believe that what they're doing is right.
In other words, they're egotistical. Egotistical maniacs in my perspective.
And yeah, that's the opposing side is all about free will, right?
Yeah.
The ability to make your own decisions, the ability to pursue your own means. And I mean, the worldview of the bad guys, right, of Pithika is if you leave people to their own devices, they will create more suffering for others because everyone is selfish.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. It does kind of remind me of Death Note. Because you have a character who like thinks that he can make a new world order, like you said, mm-hmm. and he's coming from a perspective of there is so much corruption in the world and people are really selfish, and you know, if I got rid of all the serial killers and all the rapists in the world, then the world would be a better place. And I am as a person who is I guess like with Light in Death Note, he is an upstanding citizen. He, mm-hmm. you know, he's like a genius. His dad is a police commissioner. So he's like, I am the one who can pull this off. And with L, who is on the opposite side, he has the same argument, free will. And also, you are not God. You
right.
cannot make those calls. And it's a story that's been told repeatedly in all media, but vastly different because it yeah. is centered on character. And I think Hwang did a good job establishing all of the characters and their moral codes and how they kind of clash with each other.
Right, because even between Cass and Arthur, there are clashes in morality, right? I mean, I feel like I was saying there's an opposing view to whatever Pithika's doing, but there really isn't, because I feel like the protagonists, they're more neutral than anything else, right? There's no right or wrong for them. They're just trying to survive, which in itself, I guess it's the free will argument or the ability to self-determine. But like Cass isn't like, she's a good person, but not like a good person, you know?
Not a good person in italics.
Yeah.
She is someone who, you know, who pulls the trigger before thinking. And, you know, she kind of is on the side of the ends justifies the means in a mm-hmm. much, much smaller scale, because she thinks, oh, if I don't shoot, then I will get hurt.
Right.
And if I don't tie up loose ends, they'll come after me. So
right. So you can see, like, Pithika's goal, like Donna's goal is pretty much Cass's worldview expanded to cover...
Which is why she's able to get into Cass's head through logical arguments. And I thought that was a really good scene with, I think it's like, what, like 250 pages in. You are at like the middle of the second act where Donna and Cass are sitting across from each other.
Right, she's been captured.
Yeah, and Donna's like, ask me anything. And I was like, that's so weird because you don't really see... like this kind of like conversation between villain and protagonist.
Right. Usually it's the monologue. It's the exposition. It's the exposition dump where the villain explains
yeah.
their plan.
And it's just like weird, like, oh, conversations over coffee, you know, like, oh, ask me anything. And like kind of like the villain making very sound arguments and also just like being pretty chill about everything.
Yeah.
Like, that was a really interesting scene for me to read. As someone who, I don't know how I would categorize myself. Like, I'm lawful something, but like, Cass and I did not really mesh well.
Right. You're more of an Arthur.
Yeah, I really am, and I like kind of hate it. Considering that, like, a lot of my friends are more like Cass, who are just like, yeah, like, whatever. Like, it's like we have to create a little bit of chaos to you know, make good progress or whatever. Whereas with me, I was kind of on the side of Arthur. So I was like, why are you shooting all the time? like, why are you pulling the trigger before you're actually thinking about the consequences? Because she really does not seem to think that far ahead as someone who is, like, super good at mathematics and being able to dodge bullets.
Well, I mean, that entire scene where she gets, like, caught at a supermarket.
Oh my god, I was like... screaming. I was just like mentally screaming at that scene where she's like, okay, I just have to stay on the down low until I can leave the city. But she's like, oh, what if I get alcohol? And I'm like, dude, you're on like a wanted poster. Like, you shot bullets at Griffith Park in front of so many people. Like, what makes you think that this is a good idea? And then she goes and she doesn't have her ID. And I'm like, how do you not, like, have the forethought to, like, do this?
I mean, do you think that's, like, a contradiction in her character? Or is that, like, just... I mean, she does say herself in the story that she does not do well when she's not actively solving a problem or working on something. And, like, these poor life decisions, poor survival decisions seem totally, like... If you were truly all about self-preservation, you wouldn't have made these decisions.
Yeah, they're
right?
Very, very self-destructive.
Yeah. And... I mean, I wonder if that's something that they'll explore in future books. Because obviously there is, like, something that I started to notice as we got closer to the book. I was like, oh, we're getting closer to the book. And we're nowhere near any idea of who Cass is. You know, and like even her past, right? Because throughout the entire story, she never ever talks or thinks about who she was before the book, right? How she became the way she is. And that seems intentional based on where the story goes. But it really does like give you the sense that like she, like this personality, this like this life that she lives, it's something that she constructed herself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, no one person is consistent with their their code. And, like, that scene where she's about to get caught and Checker's on the phone with her. And he's like, you need to turn yourself in. I'll get you out. But, like, you need to – that is your only option. And she's like, screw you. I have grenades. And I was just like, what makes you think that this is an okay idea? Like – Checker is a hacker. He's going to, like, break you out.
Right.
But that's what makes Cass, like, a pretty good character because she has all these trust issues and creates so many problems and so much conflict. And a lot of this book is about characters making really, really bad decisions, whether it's their own decisions or it's being influenced by Pithika. Mm. And then them trying to, like, clean up after their mistakes.
Right.
Yeah. I did get a little bit frustrated, though, with me not knowing where her math power came from. Because I knew that this was part of a series, but I kind of wish that, like, there was a conversation about that. Like, with trusting being like, okay, like, you're super weird. You're like Spider-Man. Like, you're able to, like, do all of these incredible calculations. And, like, I thought there would be, like, a moment where he asks her, like, how are you able to do this? When did you learn how to, like, train and stuff like that?
I mean, you can tell that he's suspicious, right? But he's also very trusting.
I guess?
Trusting. Because his name is Trusting.
Who is your favorite character, by the way? Because we had a great... ensemble cast, I think.
I was super sad that they killed off the precocious girl right off the bat.
Oh, yeah. A 12-year-old girl who is into hacking and guns.
And, like, the gruff information broker who also pays his taxes because he believes in civil service.
Yeah.
I did enjoy that she was able to avenge them in the end. But in terms of, like, more, the more substantial characters in the story, I think I... Maybe it's just because she's the protagonist and you spend the most time with her, but I did like Cass as a character. She was a great anti-hero. I love that... like, the story in itself is full of, like, diverse characters, right? You have people of color, you have female protagonists, you have disabled characters. But it doesn't, like... I actually didn't think about this till the very end, but there was no romance storyline, and I really, really, like,
yeah, I really thought that was refreshing. That too. Yeah. I really liked her relationship with Rio.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we're friends, but not really. And also, like, we have this relationship where we really trust each other and know each other that well.
But so there's that thing that Rio keeps saying throughout the book that we're not friends. And I feel like that's important.
You think, like, he's her handler or something?
I mean, later on, well, if we want to jump into, like, wild mass guessing about the backstory, and, like, this is, I haven't read the second book, so I don't know if they go into this, but it feels like, so there are a couple clues in the book where you kind of, you see connections between Cass and Donna, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of when Checkers, the hacker, mentions that, yeah, Donna was originally Miss Psyche, Cycle? I forgot her name.
Sayo?
Yeah. She was kidnapped at a young age and trained, or, like, brought in at a young age and trained to develop her skills that she already had. And that affected Cass some in a way that's, like, it was very subtle, but you can tell that she was, like, bothered by that. And the fact that Donna figures out who Cass really is leads me to believe that they're connected in, like, they're connected somehow in that way. So there's that one chapter where they're doing, like, battle in the mindscape, kind of like, I know you don't watch Marvel stuff, but
I mean, I've watched, like, my fair share.
Have you seen Legion?
No, I have not.
They do this on Legion where they go into, like, the astral plane and they do battle mentally, right? It kind of felt like that, where they're on, like, this other, like this level of, I guess it's like Inception then, right? Where
they're
in
so.
The subconscious, where time moves differently and more slowly. And she's starting to get glimpses of her past. And so my theory is she also has mind powers, and that Rio is someone who she put under her, like, control.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why they have this bond. And that's why Rio keeps saying, I'm not your friend. Because maybe he really isn't.
Oh, good guess. Good guess. Kind of reminds me of Harry Potter, actually, with the occlumency, like, where you learn mind battle skills. Like, there are people who can read minds and kind of influence people. And then you have the skill of blocking things. So I thought that was, like, really interesting when, like, Cass is like, don't remember. Do not try to remember under any circumstances. And she has mental defenses, like going through equations and stuff when she's talking to Donna, just in case she doesn't know about her mathematics skills.
Right.
And, you know, Donna doesn't know about her mathematics skills until the very end, where she's kind of like putting a sledgehammer into her mental state.
What did you think about the relationship with... What did you think about Rio? Because, like, as an Asian American-focused podcast, Rio is our representation on the screen, right? He was pretty, like, I love that she kept mentioning that he wore a really cool duster.
Oh my God, yeah. Fashion is key. I didn't even know that, like, Rio was our Asian representation.
They mentioned it a couple times that he's Asian.
Oh, it must have, like, just flew past my head.
It was in the first chapter, I think.
See, that's the thing about, like, the descriptions on the diverse characters. It's so subtle. And, like,
I think she literally says Asian.
Yeah, but, like, Japanese. I don't know. Yeah. Like, Same thing with like Checker. Like Checker is in a wheelchair, mm-hmm. and I don't think I like caught that until like maybe like much later on when they're trying to get him to a working computer right. after everything is shut down in California and Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's they didn't call out explicitly that he was in a wheelchair till later. I think right, they kind of alluded to it in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way, like you're not told that Arthur Treisting is black until like a couple chapters into knowing him too. Yeah. I feel like, right?
Yeah. Same thing with Cass. Mm-hmm. I mean, like she does say like, oh, a lot of people think that I'm like
Middle Eastern
or Latinx. And when she is arrested after that grocery store stunt that she did, the police mention, was it the police? I don't know. Someone mentioned that like a Pakistani girl got beat up because they thought it was her.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, it's very, very subtle. And I do really prefer that because it doesn't feel like tokenizing.
Yeah. But I wonder in your mind's eye how you casted them before you realized or before you were told who they were. Because I feel like, I don't know if this was the author's intent or it's just like the author just writing them as real people, and it's on us to not assume.
I'm sure that there are a lot of readers who assumed that they were white, and then they had a rude awakening in the middle of reading it, and it's kind of like you know, the author reprimanding them, being like, like white people aren't default characters,
right? I mean, I don't, yeah. Do you think it was the author trying to, like, do you think that was the intent, was to, like, give a middle finger to those people?
Or? No, I don't think so. I think, I feel like that's way too much work.
Right.
But I did get the sense that Arthur was black, like, pretty early on. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was the way he spoke. It seemed a little bit more urban. And also, like, when they go to his office, they describe the neighborhood to be pretty sketchy.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, if this was a white PI, he's probably doing more like, I don't know, like, my husband is cheating on me, so take a photo. So that would be in a more, like, middle class neighborhood. And I guess it's because we read IQ that my mind just jumped there.
Okay. I mean, I think he did mention that that's what he normally does, is surveillance and following people around.
I think
waiting.
That's just a PI bread and butter. I don't know. Like, for some, like, I would have to comb through the book again, and I'm not sure if I will do that. But I think that he was black early on.
See, I didn't realize it. Maybe that's on me for, like, or just the way that the world has trained me. But I thought, like, hardball detective, I thought, like, you know, that kind of, like, noir.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really think about your own biases until they're, like,
exposed to you.
Shoved in your face. Yeah. Like that. I'm like, oh, shit. He's black. I'm an asshole. You know? But I do like that their race wasn't a character trait, right? Which is something that a lot of, like, less skilled authors would do. It's like, oh, their character is black guy. Right?
Yeah.
Whereas here, like, Arthur was hard-boiled detective first.
One issue that I did have with the book was pacing. It just felt like so much was happening. Like, they're, like, running from one organization, and then you have, like, an explosion, and then they're in hiding again, and they're going back to do some snoop work. And,
yeah.
Like, at some point, like, maybe, like, like 200 pages in, I'm like, so many things are happening. And I keep feeling that this is the end of the second act, but I know that there's so many pages left. So I'm like, what other discoveries, what other incidents can happen to escalate the plot?
See, I feel like, I guess that's where my experience in watching spy thrillers came in handy, because to me, the pacing felt good.
Okay, like, so it's like standard pacing for a spy thriller?
Yeah, because you're not, like I said in the beginning, it's not a detective story. You're not unraveling a mystery. You are It's basically like, it's the original Mission Impossible, where it's...
I also haven't seen the original Mission Impossible.
The movie, not the TV series, where it's like multiple organizations with their own agendas coalescing in one point and seeing who comes out on top. And you're kind of thrown in the middle of that, where you are constantly reacting to things happening, people executing on their agendas, right? And see, this is where I'm not a film major. I'm not like a writing major. Like I don't have the language to talk about narrative structure and tropes and all that, which maybe we should have some writers on to talk about that with.
Yeah.
But the pace at which things happen and unfurl does track with like this type of story, where you're just constantly like, the point isn't to uncover the mystery. The point is to like unfubar this situation.
But right? Like, I feel like when Pithika, they, you know, pretty much shut down Los Angeles and I guess the entire state of California, to be honest, I thought that should have come like way, way sooner. And
well, it wouldn't fit with their MO because they're not trying to disrupt the status quo.
Yeah, they aren't. But that's what I thought in terms of pacing. Like they should have figured out how to take down Pithika with their finances like much earlier, in my opinion. I feel like the book could have been tightened to like 300 pages instead of 352 pages.
Well, I feel like narratively, they didn't have the tools to until they realized that Arthur had picked up the flash drive, right? So maybe that might have come earlier. But again, that wouldn't have come unless Cass and Arthur built this relationship with each other, right? Because at the beginning, they weren't on the same team. They're reluctant allies, maybe, but they weren't like, they weren't working together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I understand like the buildup to it. I just felt like it should have been tightened a little bit more. And also, like at some point, I towards the end of the second act, I kind of got sick of Arthur being really untrustworthy, because it was just like, okay, like I get it, you've been brainwashed, and like this has happened like 4 times already, where he's kind of like thwarted their.
Yeah.
It kind of compromised their mission. And I was like, okay, well, it's good that Huang made that part of the plan at the very end, where it's like, okay, we're counting on him to call Donna, because that's part of our plan now. But I just don't know. I kind of got tired of it. And I feel like that could have been shortened much more.
I felt like it was like... Because from that point in the story on, after they get captured, everything is suspect. And I thought that was really well done, where you're at this point where nothing he says, nothing Cass says to herself can be trusted, really. And I thought that was a good tension during that part, personally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't disagree with the tension, just pacing. I don't know. Like, I don't know how else to describe it other than, like... Like the prose should have like been tightened a little bit more, so you don't have to go through so many pages to get to the next, next major beat. But that depends on personal preference. I mean, Marvin, you're more of like a fantasy person, like a fantasy or like,
I think they call it genre.
Yeah. Well. Well, like with fantasy novels, like you have to go through so many pages because there's so much world building and so many characters. And then like for me, I prefer something that is like much more tighter in terms of like page numbers. I don't know if that's because I went to film school and like screenplays are like you have such a short window to tell so much information.
Maybe. So. And maybe if this was a movie, they would tighten it up, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. When I was reading the book, I thought like, wow, the writing is so cinematic and it would make a great movie. But a lot of the prose, it can be told within like a glance or with just like really short dialogue or special effects. But in a book, you have to write all of that down and kind of explain it. So yeah, but it would make a really good movie. And I'm kind of being hypocritical because I have read a lot of Dan Brown novels and they're also like kind of in the same genre umbrella of like spy thrillers mm-hmm. or like just like conspiracy thrillers.
Right.
And it's like so many pages, like 500, 600 pages. And there's like a lot of things going on, a lot of like red herrings and organizations that seem bad, but also like they are on the same side,
right.
technically. But like even with the, even with those books, I'm like, okay, like let's get it. Come on. Like let's get to the next beat. There's so much like filler in between and I don't know. But like
I guess
but then if you watch the movies, it's much tighter.
Mm. Also has Tom Hanks, so you know, it's imminently more watchable too.
Man, like,
just by the
I feel like that's a miscast.
Really?
Honestly. Yeah.
I mean, people didn't think Matt Damon could play Super Spy. He pulled it off pretty well.
I don't know.
In your brain cast for this movie, mm-hmm. who would play Rio?
Who would play Rio? Oh, man. I don't know.
Who is the buff? Because he's a big guy, right?
Isn't he a big guy?
Is he a big guy? I don't remember now.
I don't know.
He's imposing, right? He's like...
I think it doesn't matter like the body type, but like the actor would have to give off that psychopath vibe where it's like he can just be standing still and it would be like terrifying.
Right.
So I'm trying to think of actors who could pull that off because it's a lot of subtle acting.
I mean, Steven Yeun has been known to play charming, creepy guys, but I don't think that's the character.
No.
It's not charming, creepy.
No.
He's like menacing, scary.
Yeah, menacing, scary.
Right. Hmm.
Well, if you think of somebody, please.
Have we had that character? I guess Rick Yoon from his James Bond work.
I don't know.
Is he too pretty? He's
yeah,
probably too pretty.
He's probably too handsome. I mean, that's a good compliment to give somebody, but. yeah, if you have any ideas about who could play Rio, please let us know in the Goodreads forums or tweet us because my brain is just like it's
what about
gone.
What about Arthur? Who would be a good Arthur? Who's like a good like I'm too old for this shit, like Murtaugh, but not Danny Glover type of person?
Samuel Jackson.
He's too bombastic, though,
that's
isn't
true,
he?
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Oh, my God.
Lakeith did play L, right? Or not L? Did he play L? Lakeith Stanfield in the movie?
You
probably didn't watch it because it was terrible.
Oh,
anyways.
Shoot. No, the name is escaping me. Hold on. I'm going to look. Idris Elba?
Oh.
He would be pretty good, right?
He'd be pretty good. Yeah. He's a very versatile actor, and
yeah,
he'd be great.
He'd be a solid actor.
Yes.
Yes. We got one person in. Who would be a checker? Who would be a good checker?
Oh, I don't know. Tom Holland. I feel like we need to get someone who is
actually disabled. Which would be nice.
Which would mean we'd have to get someone probably unknown.
That's
right?
True.
Because there's not, I don't know if there's many, at least not prominent actors in the industry who are actually disabled. A lot of people playing disabled, but not.
I really liked Checker. And
yeah.
I really liked how he was introduced and how he kind of like added more punch, I think. Like, I don't know, like because he added like more humor to it, I felt
grateful for his existence.
Yes. I mean, but I feel like that is an archetype in a lot of like media. You have a hacker who has a lot of personality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess, are you interested in reading the second book?
I don't know.
Because I kind of feel like I'm in it in a way where like I'll eventually probably crack it open or at least get the audiobook to listen to it on my drive because mm-hmm. I'm interested in what's happening.
Yeah.
And I did read the description for the second book, and it sounds like they're dealing with the fallout of them taking down Pithica. Because, yeah, the final like moral quandary of this book is you have this organization that is obviously doing some heinous shit, but also keeping the world relatively peaceful and making it a better place. And by taking them down, you are essentially unleashing or unshackling a lot of bad people and bad actors, right? So, like, again, this this tension between order and chaos, which mm-hmm. is preferable, which is right. Which one is more right?
Well, what about you? What side do you stand on?
I mean, I'm always going to be on the side of free will.
Yeah, same here.
Just because, I don't know, and we don't have time to go into this because we're already pretty deep into the episode, but Donna Polk's power to, like, kind of not just convince you of her righteousness, but to fundamentally change your own, like, moral center, that's, like, that's, it's violence. It's mental violence, right?
It's doing, abuse.
Yeah.
It's how, that's what gaslighting is. I am of the side where, you know, people need free will, and that if you think that everyone should think in the same way as you and actually put in the effort to, like, brainwash people or to, like, make them do your dirty work,
mm-hmm.
that mindset of, like, I'm always right and people should just fall under my ruling, it is a very egotistical way of thinking. And a lot of terrible things have happened in world history with that mindset. So I'm always on the side of, you know, like, of free will. And
yeah.
you are not God, so therefore you should not play as God.
And I think in terms of, like, worldview, I err more on Arthur's side rather than Cassus, where Cassus is all about, like, self-preservation. Do what you must to protect yourself and mm-hmm. yours. Whereas Arthur has this sense of, like,
responsibility for other people and consequence. Like, he knows consequences.
And the belief that people are fundamentally good.
Or has the possibility.
Right. Yeah, the potential being for being good.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if this is where the story is leading, but this is where, like, a lot of media, like, that talk about this type of thing is asking is it worth it to put stock, to put trust in the fact that humanity will tend to do the right thing eventually?
Right? Eventually. That is the key word, eventually. Yeah. This is, like, completely, not completely random, but every single time Cass, like, stole a car or a motorcycle, my gut instinct was just like, you are a terrible person.
She is the player character in a Grand Theft Auto book.
Like
video game. Like, honestly, like, yeah, she has bullet time, essentially. And she's able to, like, murder a bunch of people. And she's good at stealing cars.
I mean, like, it's set in L.A. And I'm like, if you steal someone's vehicle, you know, like, you're pretty much, like, they pretty much can't go anywhere. So, like, as, like, an L.A. person.
That's why she stole a motorcycle. You've been there. You've sat in rush hour gridlock traffic and the motorcycle just zooms. Because motorcycles are allowed to split lanes, they just zoom right past you. And you're like, damn it.
No, I don't say damn it. Do you know why? Because those are death machines. I will never get a motorcycle. And any friends that do have motorcycles, I, like, so much anxiety, like, rises up because I'm like, you could easily get killed or maimed or something.
What about a moped?
No.
Not as fast.
No. I'm scared of bicycles, okay? Like, I'm scared of those, like, motorized scooters that are everywhere in downtown LA. Like, I hate them so much because, one, this is your PSA in terms of those stupid bird scooters. Yeah, like, two of my friends have used those scooters, and they have both gotten into serious accidents. One of them fractured his back, and the other one broke his arm and leg. So I am of the belief of you need to be in a vehicle where there is a seatbelt. And if you're thinking about getting a motorcycle, please wear a helmet that fits your size. Because Cass is like, I don't want to wear a helmet, or this helmet is too big, and screw the California law of wearing a helmet. And I'm like, this is not lining up with my
you
sensibilities.
And Cass would not be friends.
No, we wouldn't
be constantly exasperated. She stressed you out, I bet.
Huh? Yeah, yeah. So when Arthur was like, I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that, And he's like, you should really follow the law.
I got you. You and Arthur are on the same wavelength.
Yes, we are.
Well, on that note, I guess that'll do it for our discussion of Zero Sum Game by S.L. Huang. The second book, Null Set, is out now if you're interested in continuing the adventures of Cass Russell. And if you have anything to add or to bring up about the discussion that we've had on Zero Sum Game, please let us know again on our Goodreads forums. We do have a thread going that's very lonely right now. So
yeah, it is very lonely right now. I know a lot of people tend to read the books after we talk about it. I don't know, like, I don't know if we become like the Spark Notes of Asian and Asian American literature, where people listen to us first and they're like, okay, I got the gist of the
plot. I mean, if that's the case, what are you doing? That is.
I also know that a lot of people tend to listen to our book news episode more.
That's true.
But, you know, if you're listening to our discussion episodes, please let us know on Goodreads forums.
Let us know if we're doing this right.
Yeah, let us. I mean, we do want to change things up a little from time to time. So it would be nice to get your suggestions. But for the month of August, our book club pick is Severance by Ling Ma. And it's kind of like a satirical post-apocalyptic novel.
Okay.
It's like, it takes place in Silicon Valley. I think it's Silicon Valley. And, you know, a zombie apocalypse kind of happened. Okay. Or kind of like a plague has kind of wiped out a lot of humanity.
Is this our first post-apocalyptic story?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know.
I feel like How to Survive in the Science Fiction Universe was kind of post-apocalyptic.
But not really, because there's a society that's
true.
Like,
it's more future dystopia.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, in Severance, it kind of focuses on a Chinese-American woman who is kind of like by her lonesome during this like post-apocalyptic era. So it will be fun for us to read. It's a little bit different. We try to read different stories and try to like switch things up a bit. This book is shorter than the other books that we have read, so it should be a breeze.
That's good, because I am also currently making my way through Jade War.
Oh,
by
yeah.
Fonda Lee. If you guys want to chat about that book, I'll start a thread and we can.
Are you going to start a thread about Dragon Republic as well? Because that's coming out this month.
That book is real good. Have you finished the Poppy War yet?
No, I haven't. Mm. Yeah. I have a lot of books on my Kindle by Asian and Asian American authors. No. And it's like, if it's $2, I tend to buy it. And it just stays in my Kindle until we decide to read it.
The second book is a lot less dark, but a lot more focused than the first book. In terms of content.
That would make sense.
Like, the themes are still pretty intense, but there's a lot less the stuff that will make you queasy. But yeah, Rira, thanks so much for discussing this book. We got a lot of mileage out of this one. I enjoyed our conversation.
We've learned more about each other's moral codes. And I'm sure our listeners have learned more about us as people. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but hey.
And yeah, thanks to everyone for listening in. A couple quick shout outs before we take off. Thanks to the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts that we're a part of. You can learn more about our fellow Potluck podcasts by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. And thanks also to Visual Communications. Our podcast was recorded at the VC offices in Little Tokyo at the Potluck Podcast Studio. They're an amazing arts and media organization behind the annual LA Asia Pacific Film Festival, and you can learn more about them by going to their website at vcmedia.org. And yeah, Rira, thanks for joining me again.
And I guess
we'll see you next time.
Yeah, next time.
All right.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
But we're still here. We're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history, We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turns gallery institution Giant Robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app.